Historical Context, F.A. Hayek and the Road to Serfdom, was presented by Charlie Dewberry on August 13, 2009, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of the teaching.
In my remarks, since I'm assuming most of you saw the film yesterday, I'm going to assume that that portion of Hayek for today, I'm going to talk about Hayek as the individual economist that's the focus of the reading today, and the individual economist that I'm going to focus on. I'm going to assume that you got most of the biographical and economic information from the film. I'll just highlight very briefly those. And then the last thing I'm going to do here is essentially I want to come back and look at the question, because it's a live, real question for me that I'm wrestling with, is in what sense is the economy of Adam Smith similar to the economy that existed, say, at the end of World War II or not? Is it pretty similar, so it's pretty continuous, and so the economic system is similar, so Smith's system would easily then be applicable to the modern system, or is it not the case? So that's the question I'd like to come back and at least address a little bit before we leave. And I'll see about getting us out here roughly on time, so I'll make my remarks pretty short. So for Hayek, as you got from the film, Austrian, basically grew up in a noble family on the lower end of nobility in Austria. I found it interesting, I didn't know this till I was starting to do the work for this. His second cousin was Ludwig Wittgenstein, and his best friend was Karl Popper, who was a famous philosopher of science. So I didn't know that until starting to do this. So all of a sudden, it's a small world. These are pretty tight connections here. He also, in addition to writing economics, he worked on neuroscience, and in fact, he wrote a critique of Mach's idea of sensation. Based on his work in neuroscience, he critiqued the positivists and Mach's idea about sense datum, for those of you who looked at that in philosophy or neuroscience, either one. So anyway, he dabbled in a lot of different things. So the few comments I'd like to make about Hayek, which I think will help. Always when you read a book and you read like chapter 1, 2, and then 11, or like we found yesterday, you read chapter 24, there's huge gaps. And so all I'd like to do is very quickly just sort of fill in the gaps. Many of them were talked about in the film, but I just want to highlight some things. So I'll highlight here the differences between Keynes and Hayek. And so yesterday I tried to be as sympathetic as I could to Keynes, and give as sympathetic as possible presentation of Keynes as I can. Today, I'll likewise try to do that for Hayek, and I'll interact with Keynes just briefly. Hayek's points against Keynes are basically this. When you boil it all down and look at it, you cannot have a system that's organized and decentralized. Those two things are ultimately incompatible. So, and everybody sort of recognizes that central planning is repugnant. So what we'd like to do is sort of have a mix, a mixture. But Hayek's key point here is, yes, but remember my first premise, my first observation. It can't be organized and decentralized at the same time. That in the end is going to turn out to be important. There is no middle ground here, ultimately, is what he's saying. He also said that a major socialist assumption here is that planning is inevitable. And the argument they give is we're compelled by circumstances beyond our control, just the change in technology. So for example, let's take computers and software. Let's say we're going to completely decentralize that. Everybody's going to have their own operating system. Well, it ain't going to work. Change in technology here Their argument is that forces us towards a monopoly. And we don't like it, but it forces us towards that, and we're compelled by that, those technological changes, and they're inevitable, and we don't want to stop them. But it's inevitable that we're going to move towards a monopoly. Hayek's reply to that is really? Where's your real proof for that? Is that really true? So one of the first things he's questioning is, why do you think that? Why do you think it is inevitable? Basically, he's arguing that's a story that's been told long enough that everybody sort of believes it. The other main point that he's making is, and it's central element in his beliefs, is if there is planning, let's look very careful at what planning is. Planning is choosing to do something, a particular thing. Planning inevitably, then, is going to benefit somebody and not benefit somebody else. It's inevitable that if you're choosing the goal, some people are going to benefit and some aren't. And what he's saying is the inevitable outcome of that is totalitarianism. That destroys freedom. So those are the parts of the book we skip. So I thought I'd at least fill that in a little bit, because out of that then, our chapter 11 on the aspect of truth in that, I think that will help you then see the context, how Hayek sees his critique of Keynes working. Okay, so I'd like to shift gears for a few minutes and make, in the last couple minutes I have, just some observations now. Well, what we've seen is the world of Adam Smith was early in this transformation. He's coming roughly 100 and plus years after people like Francis Bacon, who started us on this road. They basically said, here's the project. Through science and technology, we're going to harness nature. We're going to harness it to provide us with material wealth. And that material wealth is going to solve the problems, the human dilemma. I mean, that's the project. And there's a way I look at that, and there's a way I can be sympathetic to that project, but there's a way that I look at that, and it absolutely scares me to death. And I think in Smith's time, you're still able to sort of look at that and go, well, yeah, okay. Within a certain context, yeah. But one of the things I want to point out here is I think the context has changed. And I'd like to present a couple of quick instances of that. One is, in Smith's view, economics is not ultimately going to become all that important. It's going to be a small department, probably tucked away in a university somewhere, because we have a lot of things that are much higher value to us than that. I submit things have changed. We're listening to economists now and paying close attention to all this stuff, because we don't have exactly the same view that Adam Smith did, that this is just tucked away in a little department, part of the bigger human thing that's going on. So that's one change. Secondly, I think that early in the 20th century, there was a fundamental change towards the whole picture that David portrayed. Remember the Himalayan example? So you go up to the Himalayas, offer them something, and the point is, as soon as they accept it, they're part of this thing, and they're part of this system now. And the reason is if you get behind, then you'll economically be behind, you will no longer be able to militarily support yourself, and you're going to go extinct. You're going to die out. Well, that's a picture everybody more or less accepted. And in a certain context, I think even in Smith's time, you could still be optimistic about that. But what I would argue is after World War I, there isn't any longer any optimism. What did it bring? Mass murder. World War I, 20 million, and then to put the exclamation point on the end, 50 million in World War II, at least. All of a sudden, Western civilization is beginning to look at that picture of that story of this is what it was about, and there's no longer optimism. It's no longer the picture that science and technology are going to harness nature and we're going to solve the problems of man. That's changed. It's not an optimistic picture anymore. Now, with regards to economics itself, I want to say the economic system under which that Adam Smith had in mind when he wrote his theory and talked about it is not our economic system. And I'd like to make several points about that. The first is just the observation that during Smith's time, he saw incredible technological development. He saw the industrialization starting. One individual could begin to produce more. One individual could begin to harness tools that would allow him to gain greater control over the natural economy. In Smith's time, remember this is like 1776, in Smith's time largely, the natural resources of the world were boundless. There was little scarcity. Take even, for example, wood. There was local scarcity, and in Europe there are local places of scarcity. But if you look at the writings during this time, there's optimism. Why? There's a whole new continent out there. There's boundless resources, and they're cheap. They're boundless and they're cheap, and we'll just consider them the raw materials in our system. I would argue that by the time we've gotten to the 20th century, that's changed. Those frontiers are largely gone. And technologically, we've evolved the ability now that one human being with the tools available to him can, for the first time in human history, harvest wood faster than it grows. That's changed. That now creates a scarcity of a kind that never existed in Smith's time. Never. He could see local. But at his time, I'm not aware of anybody who saw global shortages of raw materials to run this system. So that's changed. Second, the size of organizations changed. The size of a modern corporation was unimaginable, really, in Smith's time. But there's two other aspects of corporation I would like to point out. One, corporate structure wasn't around. There were the forerunners of corporate structure at his time. But I would like to argue, I think corporate structure itself changed the economy. Now, why is that? Let's look, for example, the purpose for corporate structure given by the proponents of corporate structure and its development in the U.S. system. So in U.S. corporate structure, there's five or six elements. I'm going to highlight two. One, limited liability to the shareholders. Your liability is only limited to the money you have in it. Two, we're going to diffuse responsibility for the action of this institution. We're creating a new legal entity here that's an entity that it itself is the legal responsible entity called the corporation. Its purpose is to more rapidly consolidate and accumulate wealth. And the proponents of it, now not universally, so this is a little bit debatable, but many of the proponents of it and all the opponents of it said this: but this individual you've created is unlike a human individual that functions with guidance of complex moral guidelines. What the proponents are saying, look, we're getting rid of all that stuff because this structure is going to allow this system to work better, more efficiently. We'll be able to get more capital, and we won't have to worry about all this moral responsibility stuff. It's a way we can maximize our investment in speed in converting our economy. That's a change. In fact, when I was looking at Adam Smith for this, I found it interesting. Smith, I would argue, was not a supporter of corporate structure. In fact, he would argue that that's not in the best interest of the free market economy. Not for the arguments I made, but these are his reasons. Well, if you look at any organization that's structured where the ownership is separated from the management, what's going to happen in that system is the managers are ultimately going to manage for themselves more than the shareholders. That's going to be a tension. And that tension is going to make free markets less effective. He wants the owners to be responsible for their actions. That's built in to making long-term decisions, these best long-term decisions. That's changed. One more. I got to decide which one I'm going to pick here. Okay, I'll pick this one. We said earlier that David very carefully and rightly pointed out that Smith made a distinction between long-term, your best decisions, long-term versus short-term. I think something's radically changed here. Let me give you a couple of anecdotes about what we mean by long-term, short-term. When I was in England, I just heard about this. I didn't see it, but I've seen it written, so I know it's true, but I did not see it with my own eyes. There was a lab in England, 300 or 400 years old. So it was built back 1400s. And one of the major timbers in this lab had rotted. And the debate was, what were they going to do now? Because you can't get, we need a timber 12 by 18 here, 36 feet. Where are you going to find one of those in England? Well, anyway, there was a discussion about it, but the story I saw was this, that when they built that in 1400, they built it for a few hundred years, but when they built it, the guy who was building it decided he was going to make copies of all the big timbers in this building, and he buried them in the marsh, which preserves them. So 400 years later, they dug up the timbers that he had cut in 1400 for when those timbers needed to be replaced. They would be there. Now, that's long-term. That's thinking ahead. Well, the other thing is when I go to Europe, I have a sister who lives in Ireland. Her house is 400 years old. Anybody who's been to Europe knows what I'm talking about. Americans have no clue. But so I live in a house 400 years old. That's no big deal. I'll give you a hint. The house I live in ain't going to be around in 400 years. But now, let me give you a modern example, which is, this is a real example. This is an example that I'm interacting with right now. I have a business plan. Here's my business plan. And unfortunately, because of things that have happened the last 100 years, there's got to be a caveat, a strong caveat. This is going to cost. But here's the deal. Right now, you can make 6% profit. If you will be satisfied with 4% profit 40 years, after 40 years, you can have 18 to 20% profit for at least the next 150 years. Now, with that business model today, is there any takers? I've actually marketed that to industrial timber corporations because this is about timber. It takes 100 years to grow a tree to anywhere near a modern size. I even took it to a life insurance company that now invests in trees. They just looked at it and laughed. 40 years? But see, in the natural economy, 40 years, that isn't going to do it. 150 years is a tree. Something's changed. What's changed is the speed, and we've contrasted the time. So in Adam Smith's time, when he meant long-term, he wouldn't have batted an eyelash at examples like that timber. They did that stuff. They thought in longer term. That's what it meant. 40 years? That's nothing. To us? You're telling me? Yeah, let's go out and market this. Guy gets up. Now look, what I'm saying is you only got to take a 2% cut for 40 years. How many takers? Now it's minutes, nanoseconds. And it seems to me that's a fundamental shift. And so what Smith meant by long-term in your best interest, I would argue, he'd say, yeah, Charlie, your plan. I'm with that. Why? Because in that long-term plan, you can make two or three times the amount of return you can make now. You're putting off. You're delaying your benefits for 40 years, but the results after that are going to be way more beneficial than they are now. How many takers? And in Smith's time, I would argue, there would have been takers. And if you look at the structure of the early corporations set up, either for the United States or the other early corporations set up, they were set up long-term. 40 years would have easily been within what they were looking at. That's a change. And that's a fundamental change, I would argue. And as I say, I think that has fundamental repercussions as we look at what we mean by self-interest and our long-term benefit versus our opportunism for short-term returns. I think Smith's view would be quite different from ours. And I'll stop with that.